read from my book, but around about 20 minutes. And the commitment I always make is that I will stay around after the service, so if I see anything that puzzles you or you have questions you'd like to ask, I'm more than happy to listen to the questions and do my best to answer them afterwards. So that's the deal that I made with you this morning. I was delighted when, I wasn't delighted that Jim broke COVID, but I was delighted when I was asked to step in and to discover that you were doing a series looking at the Psalms, which I think are just fantastic. Martin Luther called the Book of Psalms like a little Bible, because it contains all sorts of different aspects. And as I was preparing for this morning, looking at Psalm 8, a single word kept coming back into my mind. And it was the very small but hugely important word, awe. And the Cambridge Dictionary describes that as a feeling of great respect, sometimes mixed with fear or surprise. And I think that's the word that should always inform how we approach our God. With great respect, a bit of fear, always prepared to be surprised. And that word awe triggered another memory for me from many, many years ago when I was at university. One of my tutors, whose name I can no longer remember, I do remember he was Australian, had a catchphrase that he used. And his catchphrase was, awesome or what? Every time he got an answer from a student, he would say it was awesome or what. And we always kind of wondered what the alternative was. What was the or what part of that? But it's a phrase that has stuck with me, and I've kind of used it as a title for my talk this morning. But looking at Psalm 8, Dr. Bruce Waltke, I think I pronounced his name, described it as creation set to music. And I don't know about you, but as Tony was reading it to us, can I get that sense of a rhythm, a real depth of poetry to the psalm? And it's one of those psalms that I think stands out, in my mind anyway, and in many others, because of the majesty of the worship amongst that and some of the phrases in it. But before I go into some of the detail, I want to almost continue the space theme from the talk I gave for the girls earlier on. Because when the Apollo 11 mission was being planned, and that was the one when man first set foot on the moon, states from around the world were asked to submit messages of goodwill, which would be left behind on the surface of the moon, or whoever came along next, I guess, to look at it. And the Vatican, their contribution was Psalm 8. That was what they wanted the next people on the moon to read and know about our God, which I think seems wholly appropriate. And I think it's worth noting that this psalm is addressed directly to God. If you look at the way it's written, it's all about David speaking to God and referring to God as you. It's a personal conversation almost. And it's about man's relationship with God, the Creator, but also it goes on to be about man's relationship with the rest of the world, with the created. And at that level, this psalm is comprehensive and magnificent. But as I was reading through it, I feel that almost as soon as the writer gets started, we hit what might be described as a discordant note, a bump in the road. Because for me, the second verse seems to sit just a wee bit awkwardly in this psalm. I've called it an odd note. It's, out of the mouth of babies and infants, you have established strength because of your foes, to still the enemy and the avenger. I'm not quite sure how David, writing this psalm, got to that verse after the first verse. But if that verse seems to fit awkwardly with this psalm, I think do well to remember that enmity or opposition to God sits awkwardly within the universe. And if you look at some of the Psalms preceding this one, there is a lot of opposition to God. And what I think David's saying here is that God's way of dealing with that type of opposition is not what we might expect. Opposition to God is met by foolishness, words from the mouth of babies and infants, weakness. And of course, that's something that the Apostle Paul wrote about in 1 Corinthians, when he said that God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. So I think that the psalmist is recognising that all is not as it should be in the world, but that God will deal with it in his own way. And of course, Jesus also drew on that image of children when his disciples came to him asking, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And in Matthew's gospel, his response to them was, truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And of course, Jesus entered our world as a baby, endured the foolishness of us, the pain and humiliation of the cross, all to overcome sin and restore our relationship with God. So maybe verse 2 isn't really such an odd section at all. Maybe it's the key to truly understanding all that this wonderful psalm has to say to us, and to say about how God works in this world. An Old Testament writer, a German called Klaus Westermann, described Psalm 8 as being praise of God developed into an odd meditation on the created being, man. And I like that phrase, an odd meditation. I think it encourages us to step back and to think about how awesome God really is. And we find that in this verse that I used earlier on, verse 3. When I look at your heavens, the works of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place. And I like to think of David having a memory from his days as a shepherd, out on the hillside at night, sitting or maybe lying on his back, gazing up at the stars in the sky. This picture again, just filling his mind with these stars. This is what we might call big picture thinking. How could anyone not look up at the stars in the sky and step back in wonder? I doubt that anyone looking at the night sky looks up and thinks about how great we are. I think even the most ardent atheist must be mesmerized by the vastness of space, even if they don't acknowledge the creator behind it. And I want to use a quotation from a fairly unusual source. It's one of a favorite book of mine from my teenage years onwards, and it's Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And Douglas describes it this way, he says, space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Well, scientists have estimated that when you look up at the night sky, you can probably see about 6,000 stars. They've also estimated that in the Milky Way galaxy, there are 100 billion stars. I don't even know how many zeros you put on to make that number. But other scientists have estimated that it's 300 billion in the Milky Way. and some have thought it might be 400 billion. And that's just the Milky Way, because now scientists are also estimating that there may be trillions of galaxies out there, and I don't even know what the word for out there is, in space. So space is big, mind-bogglingly, vastly, hugely big. But that then takes me back to the pale blue dot and the smallness of man. We live on a planet that is like a speck of dust in the universe. And I think it's only natural that we should question what is our relationship to the vast God who made space when we are specks of dust living on a speck of dust. And David in the Psalm asks that very question. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? And just for the avoidance of doubt, the Hebrew word for man is better translated as human, but that's not quite as poetic and really wouldn't fit in with the psalm. But to understand the answer to this question, we need to move our brains from that mode of thinking about science and numbers and analysis to a mode where we think in theological terms. Now, I'm not going to use theological words here, but thinking in theological terms means we need to make our brains prepared to be awed. We need to start thinking about our relationship with God and start to see things from his perspective. Now, some people might think that's a bit presumptuous. How could we possibly see things from God's perspective? Well, helpfully, the psalm goes on to answer that to some extent for us as well. Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honour. This is how God views us. He treats us as almost heavenly beings. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, talking about Psalm 8, says that what stands out is the smallness the uniqueness of humans. Vulnerable, but also undeniably set apart from all other beings. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but the Hebrew word that's translated here as heavenly beings is the word Elohim. It can mean rulers or judges. It can mean divine beings or gods. And it's frequently used in the Old Testament as a name for God. So right at the start of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, we read, "In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth." That's the word that's translated as God in the first verse in the Bible. So, given that, how can we be described as being a little lower than Elohim? Well, again, the answer is also found in Genesis chapter 1. Moving on a few verses, we read God saying, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." That's why we can be described as being a little lower than the heavenly beings. We are made in the image of God. And that reflects our value to God. God supports us and provides for us and cares for us, but he also made us in his image because he has work for us to do. And that, I think, is an awesome responsibility. So verse 6 says, "You have given him dominion over the works of your hands, and have put all things under his feet." Dominion is a gift from God. It means to rule over. And Walter Brueggemann and his colleague William Bellinger say that God grants to humans the honour of representing God in caring for all of creation. sounds awesome to me. Sounds like a huge responsibility and a huge privilege. And our responsibility is comprehensive. We don't get to pick and choose which parts of creation we look after. That's also expressed towards the end of the psalm in verses 6 to 8, which I've managed to cover off the slide there, where the psalmist recognises that God has put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, also the beasts of the fields, the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, and whatever passes along the paths of the sea. We are responsible for all created things on earth. And maybe that does feel a bit overwhelming. One of my favourite writers is Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who wrote that if the divine likeness is our premise, then the question arises, how should a being created in the likeness of God act, think, and feel? How should we live in a way that is compatible with our likeness of God? So when we consider how we should be using that honour and gift of dominion, we should be asking ourselves, how would we want to be ruled? What would it mean to do that in the likeness of God? So how do we respond to all of this? Well, I think the psalm gives us a structure to help with that, because we have an awe-filled responsibility, and our response should be awe-filled as well. And the psalm starts and ends with praise. And I think that's a good model for our days, to start and end thinking about how majestic God is. Of course, you can do that at other points during the day as well, but it's a good habit to get into. And the psalm shows us through verse 2 that God can use our smallness, our foolishness. God doesn't see us as insignificant. We need to maintain a proper sense of our place, a respect for God, some genuine humility before him, but we also need to enter into relationship with him and to talk to him in the way that David did in this psalm, as almost a personal conversation. And the third thing that I think the psalm shows us is that our work is that of caretakers. Again, Brueggemann and Bellinger say this: the psalm meditates on God's amazing creation and marvels that God cares for women and men and entrusts them with the care of creation. Now, in our society, we often view caretakers as having a lowly status, yet we depend on them. Think what would happen to our buildings if caretakers didn't look after them. Think about the welfare of our old people and young people and vulnerable people if caretakers didn't look after them. Think about how many caretakers and caregivers were deemed to be key workers during our COVID lockdowns. Not the accountants, not the lawyers, people who did practical care. And that's what we are called to be for this planet and for the people who live on it. And that means forgetting about any status that we think we might have, rolling our sleeves up and getting stuck in. Think about Jesus giving up his heavenly status to come among us, healing and washing feet and dying on a cross. And we are called to follow that example. Anthony Billington of the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity says, we, this very day, embody God's gracious rule in our various activities, in relationship with others, and in a way that reflects God's own loving hand, that his name might be majestic in all the earth. And in practical terms, that means that we treat all people as being a little lower than heavenly beings, treating them with dignity, respect, and love. And it means we should do the same for our planet. But there's a whole other series in that. I'm not going to get into that today, but I want to leave you with one final thought that I've split over a couple of slides. And again, it's something that Abraham Joshua Heschel said. He said that our goal should be to live life in radical amazement. I just want to pause and let that phrase, radical amazement, settle in. Too often we can take things flippantly, not paying enough attention. What would it look like to live with radical amazement? Well, he goes on helpfully to say, that means to get up in the morning and look at the world in a way that takes nothing for granted. Everything is phenomenal. Everything is incredible. Never treat life casually. To be spiritual is to be amazed. Now, is that awesome or what? Let's stand and sing our closing hymn today, which is O Church Arise.